From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This week, we had planned two completely different shows from the ones that aired. The tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut has touched all of us here so profoundly, as I imagine it has affected you. It's a story no journalist ever wants to cover, and a story I hoped was all a dream, a nightmare that would prove untrue the next day. But what happened in Newtown is too painfully real, and for a parent like myself, almost impossible to internalize and to absorb. On this special edition of our podcast, we bring you the way we covered this story. We hoped to be a gathering place for many of you who, like us, just wanted to hear some familiar voices. In front of the White House today, the flag flies at half staff. And across the country, Americans are expressing their grief and their sense of despair. This morning, in his weekly address, the president spoke out about the tragedy.
As a nation, we have endured far too many of these tragedies in the last few years. An elementary school in Newtown, a shopping mall in Oregon, a house of worship in Wisconsin, a movie theater in Colorado, countless street corners in places like Chicago and Philadelphia. Any of these neighborhoods could be our own. So we have to come together, and we're going to have to take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this from happening, regardless of politics.
And just a short time ago, the governor of Connecticut, Daniel Malloy, also spoke.
When tragedies like this take place, people often look for answers, an explanation of how this could have happened. But the sad truth is, there are no answers. No good ones, anyway.
Joining me now, as he does most Saturdays, is James Fallows from The Atlantic. And, Jim, we have been here before, you and I, talking in the aftermath of a massacre. And yet we know they will happen again and again.
We do. That's a conversation we had after the Aurora shooting this year and after the horrific Gabrielle Giffords shooting last year. And so far, the dynamic of American politics has been we put the flags at half staff, we grieve whoever is our political leader, tears up, and then essentially nothing happens. And the question is this time whether there's anything about the horror of this case that'll make it different.
Is it different?
It's not different. It's different in its scale. It's, as we've gotten used to hearing, it's one of the worst school shootings ever. It is undeniably different in the horror of all these little children. So the question is whether finally this crosses the threshold of doing what the president said of meaningful action, something that he and politicians of all parties have avoided for recent memory.
What is meaningful action?
That is the question. I think we, on my own part, I've decided that it's worth trying to talk about gun safety as opposed to gun control, because gun control has become so embattled, so poisonous, so divisive an issue in American politics that polls show even that most average people think they have less faith that gun control will make any difference. But if we could talk about gun safety, not challenging the right of those who want to have guns to use them, but to make sure that the effects on our whole society are not as destructive as they have uniquely been. No other country is like this, with the exception of Somalia during wartime or certain Mexican drug states. If we could talk about incremental gun safety steps and enlist responsible gun owners and the NRA to that account, that might do something, but it will depend what happens the next few days, starting with the president.
After the Dunblane massacre in Scotland, I believe in 1996, the British Parliament passed very strict handgun laws. It is illegal to own a handgun, for a private person to own a handgun in Britain. Nothing like that has happened since.
And there's almost an identical case in Australia where there was the so-called Port Arthur massacre back in the 1990s in Tasmania, which was like this case in its scale. Even more people were killed then. The Conservative Prime Minister John Howard had this sweeping measure of gun control legislation, and Australia has had no large-scale killing like that since. The main counterargument in the United States is that we already have hundreds of millions of
guns
circulating around, and there is no way to eliminate them altogether. But if we recognize recognize other large-scale problems, whether it's terrorism or crime of any sort, that we're not going to deal with absolutely, but we're going to try to do something about. And it's the effort to do something that I hope we will see.
There have been turning points in the past, some turning points, notably the assassination of JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King, that did actually begin to have an impact on the national conversation.
It's true. And when I was a teenager during that era, and there were all these national politics was transformed repeatedly by assassinations, people thought, this cannot go on. And I hope that the sense in the U.S. after a year of unprecedentedly high mass shootings is that we can do something about this because we can't live this way.
That's James Fallows. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a regular on this program. Jim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Guy.
Today and tomorrow, many people around the country will turn to their spiritual leaders for answers, or at least for comfort. For nearly 30 years, Eugene Peterson served as the pastor for Christ Our King Presbyterian Church near Baltimore. In the early 1990s, he began to translate the Bible into modern-day English. It became the best-selling book called The Message. It's a book millions of Christians and non-Christians have come to rely on. Pastor Peterson has been a guest on this program in the past, and he was one of the first people we wanted to talk to after hearing the news from Newtown, Connecticut. And he's with me on the line now. And Pastor Peterson, thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
How do you retain your faith when you're faced with such a senseless tragedy?
Oh, I think about that. I think about that a lot. And everybody is just rocked by this disaster, tragedy in Connecticut. One of the things that occurred to me as I was meditating, praying, thinking about this, is the one good thing about this is that I feel like I'm so much part of a united community in America. And I thought as I woke up this morning, Jesus' second beatitude, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. It doesn't mitigate the suffering of the mourning, the loss, but it does give witness that we live in a country with a president who knows how to mourn. That's what I've been thinking about this morning.
How do you begin to cope with a kind of grief like this?
By not talking too much about it. Silence is sometimes the best thing to do, holding a hand, hugging somebody. There are no adages that explain or really make any difference to the suffering. Sometimes people say to me, I don't know what to say to these people. I say, don't say anything. Just hold their hand, hold them, hug them, and just stay around for an hour or so in silence and just be there. That's what we need at times like this, an affirmation of the sacredness of life, the holiness of life.
I know that you gave thousands of sermons over your 3 decades as a pastor, and of course, during times of crisis and in times of grief, what have you done in moments of grief? What has comforted you?
The presence of friends, mostly their silence, not talking too much. I remember when my mother died, and I had the funeral, and I broke down in the middle of the homily or the scripture reading, and I tried to contain myself, and I couldn't. And so I finally just cried. It didn't last long, maybe 20 seconds or 30 seconds. And when the service was over, I didn't want to talk to anybody. And I went into a little side room. It was not my own congregation. And sat, and my daughter came in and sat beside me. And she was about 25, 24 at the time. And a man came in I didn't know. And he put his arm across my shoulders, and he started giving me cliches and talking God talk. And after a few minutes of that, he left. And I said to my daughter, Karen, oh, Karen, I hope I've never done that to anybody. And she said, she was so dear, she says, oh, Daddy, I don't think you'd ever do that. But I had done that. But you learn not to do that when you've been through this a few times.
That's the pastor, scholar, and poet Eugene Peterson. He's the author of The Message. Pastor, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
some of the sounds from Washington's National Cathedral earlier today. In a sermon, the dean of the cathedral, Reverend Gary Hall, asked a simple question.
Why do we as a society tolerate these massacres in increasing numbers? These mass shootings are happening with increasing frequency, and they more and more seem to be targeted directly against children.
Reverend Hall is with me now, and Reverend, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
At times like these, there are many people who look to people like you for answers. What can you say?
In a tragedy, there really isn't much to say aside from just being with the people who are suffering. The problem of evil and the problem of why God allows suffering is probably the major religious problem for all religious traditions. And no tradition really finally gives a satisfactory answer. Almost every tradition just holds it up finally as a mystery. So in the face of that, it seems to me that people of faith are called not so much as to try to explain why something happened, as to simply stand with and put our arms around and care for people as they go through tragedy.
In your sermon this morning, you said, the best way to mourn the victims in Newtown is to mobilize the faith community for gun control. There is no doubt, Reverend, that there are those who will say you are politicizing a national tragedy. And what would your response be?
Well, first of all, whenever the church speaks prophetically, it's accused of engaging in politics. And it's important to remember that most of the Bible is concerned not with personal morality, but with social and public morality. In fact, the teaching of Jesus, the teaching of the Hebrew prophets, the teaching of Muhammad in the Quran, those teachings are essentially social teachings. And so in response to a national tragedy, the church's response needs to be a public response. And the way our society has decided that it engages and does its public business is through our political structures. So yes, in some sense, you might say I am politicizing a response to a tragedy, but I, for one, can't listen to another conversation where someone says, let's talk about gun control, and people say, well, it's too soon to talk about gun control. Let's grieve. And then there's a few days of grieving, and then the narrative gets changed. My intuitive sense and the sense of my bishop, Marianne Buddy, and with the other faith leaders I've talked about is, it's just really time for the faith community to be a countervailing force and to stand against this kind of violence.
That's the Reverend Gary Hall. He's the dean of the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. Reverend Hall, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Of the 12 deadliest shootings in American history, half of them have happened in the past 5 years. That's a statistic cited in a statement released yesterday by Congressman John Larson. He's a Democrat, and he's from Connecticut. And in that statement, he called for immediate measures to curb access to certain types of weapons and ammunition. Congressman John Larson joins me now on the line. And Congressman, first of all, my condolences to you and to all the people of Connecticut.
Well, thank you, Guy. You know, our hearts are broken, but we need to respond. If we do nothing, we being the Congress, we are in fact complicit. It's not an assault against the NRA or gun owners, God bless them, and I respect their right to own and carry and for recreation purposes have guns. Nothing to do with that. This is about saving lives of children. This is about preventing another massacre of this nature, and it's as much about mental health issues and a community response as well, and it is about a national conversation, as the president has indicated. But we have to act. We can't just stand and lower the flags and ache along with everybody in Newtown, Connecticut, and especially for these parents. We have a responsibility to act.
Congressman, you have called for a ban on assault weapons, a ban on high-capacity clips, background checks for all gun sales. something that, as you say, does not happen at unlicensed gun shows.
Mm-hmm.
Your state, Connecticut, has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. What could more gun control do?
Well, as I said in the release, I don't know that any specific action as it relates to providing common sense regulations will stop somebody who has the mind to do something. However, that doesn't mean that common sense practical matters shouldn't be taken as a matter of prevention. Just like after terrorist attacks, we changed the way that we look at things in this country. We changed the way that we responded because we recognized that there was a threat, that there was a danger. And as you point out, you know, these things are occurring with greater frequency and greater intensity as well.
There are, as you know, hundreds of millions of guns. It's estimated 300 million guns in private hands already in the U.S. How does a weapons ban, a new weapons ban, help make us safer, if that's the case?
Well, I think from my perspective, you put a tourniquet on and you stop the bleeding. Look, the point is this, that I don't think any single measure, you know, I don't think any single mental health measure, I don't think any single gun control measure, nor any single community-wide response in and of itself will provide the panacea. But I do think that a comprehensive approach, a common sense practical approach that both NRA owners and you know, gun control advocates would agree on, that this makes common sense. I would rather be erring on the side of common sense pragmatism and doing everything possible so that I felt that no stone was left unturned in terms of trying to protect school children.
Congressman, when you return to Washington with your colleagues, why do you think it will be different this time? I mean, there have been calls to strengthen gun laws before, obviously, especially after horrific tragedies.
Yeah.
Why will it be different this time?
I believe that the horrific nature of this, and that every single parent across this country and the innocence of these kids is just so shocking and horrific that I believe that, and it's my hope, that Congress will respond.
That's Democratic Congressman John Larson from Connecticut. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Guy.
Paul Barrett wrote a book on how guns became so pervasive in America. It's called Glock, and in a recent article for Business Week magazine, he wrote about why he believes stricter gun laws may not make a difference and why he believes things like assault weapons bans are utterly pointless.
Because there's nothing distinctively lethal about the guns that tend to be labeled assault weapons. That's just another term, a sort of pejorative term for a military-style semi-automatic rifle, which means a rifle that fires one round for each pull of the trigger. We tried banning certain assault weapons in the 1990s. Two things happened. One, the gun industry immediately found its way around the ban by simply tinkering with the design of guns. And two, criminologists have been unable to identify any significant effect on crime rates that they can link to that particular piece of legislation. And actually, there's a third point to make, which is this style of rifle really had not been particularly popular among gun buyers, had not been pushed heavily by gun sellers until it was banned, until it became notorious. And then, as happens pretty consistently with our strange, you could even say perverse, firearm marketplace in this country, when you try to restrict something, you try to ban it, it makes it more popular among people who like guns.
We mentioned to John Larson something that you have pointed out in your work, which is that there are hundreds of millions of guns in private hands in this country. So what difference would it make? He acknowledges that these kinds of laws may not end gun violence and these kinds of tragedies, but that something has to be done. That's his argument.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very, very understandable on a human level and an emotional level to say and to deeply believe that something must be done, and something must be done immediately, and it has to be dramatic. And banning a weapon that you see as being particularly dangerous feels like you're getting something done. But it's also important to distinguish between symbolic gestures and the particular goal you're trying to accomplish. And that's why when approaching these issues, as difficult as they are, and in the wake of a horrific massacre like this, as difficult as it is to think clearly, we really do need to pause, take a deep breath, and ask, what can we do in the short term, medium term, long term, that is actually likely to prevent this type of event?
Well, what would you do?
Well, when I go to Yankee Stadium to attend a Yankees game, I get searched. So does everybody else who goes into the stadium. The very first thing I would do in connection with deterring or stopping or ameliorating the impact of mass shootings in public places would be to increase security. This is not a panacea. This is not a very satisfying or emotionally resonant response. It doesn't ban anything. It seems very mundane. But if I owned a movie theater, or I ran a house of worship, or I supervised a school, I would make sure that you had armed security the way we do in front of federal court buildings, in front of other government buildings, and the type of security that we routinely accept these days at sports stadiums and at airports.
But Paul, you're talking about a potential massive expansion of the private security industry in this country. Is that the kind of America you want to see?
No, that's not what I want. I realize this is not a very emotionally or politically satisfying answer, but it is my first best answer for something that can be done about particular public places if you want to try to diminish the danger, if you actually want to do something.
Well, what's the second answer?
My second answer is that we begin a very thorough review of how we as a society deal with mental illness and the intersection between mental illness, criminal behavior, and violence. Right now, it is almost impossible for the relatives or friends or colleagues of someone who's older than 18 years old to get them some type of forced medical treatment if their behavior begins to appear threatening. We have a very porous, disorganized system for dealing with that situation, and I think we need to talk much more and figure out a different set of rules for what people can do when they see a loved one, a work colleague, a student, what have you, beginning to deteriorate. And we need to figure out how to separate those people from weapons, make sure they get medicated, and make sure that this mentally ill person doesn't commit some other lesser crime and end up in prison. We have hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people in prison. Our de facto social policy right now is to warehouse them in prisons. That's not working either, and that's the area that I would focus on. You'll notice that neither of my responses immediately requires a debate about the Second Amendment. It could be worked on in parallel alongside a debate about gun control. And by the way, there are certain gun control changes that I support too, but I don't have the illusion that they would prevent mass killings like the one we've just witnessed.
That's Paul Barrett. He's an assistant managing editor and a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's also the author of the book Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul Barrett, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on your show.
Fred Rogers, better known as Mr. Rogers, was often asked by parents how to explain death to children. And so on his program one day, he decided to try and deal with that challenge. And here's how he started.
When I was very young, I had a dog that I loved very much. Her name was Mitzi. Mm-hmm. And she got to be old, and she died. And I was very sad when she died. Because she and I were good pals. Mm-hmm. And when she died, I cried.
Fred Rogers wrote a book about parenting, and in that book, he addressed grief. He had a singular way of communicating that idea directly to children.
Sometimes people get sad, and they really do feel bad. But the very same people who are sad sometimes are the very same people who are glad sometimes.
Last night, we read a blog post by LeVar Burton. He's the man behind Reading Rainbow and someone profoundly influenced by Fred Rogers. And in that blog post, he offered parents some advice.
Kids have an amazingly accurate radar for being aware of what's going on around them, even when the adults in their lives are pretending like nothing is happening. And so my experience is that you really are best served by being age-appropriately candid with children, especially when it comes to dealing with their fears. These events terrorize all of us, adults as well as children. And I can certainly remember from my childhood the way my imagination used to fill in the blanks, absent any concrete information from the adults in my world. And so my advice to parents is always to let our kids know that whatever you're experiencing, it's okay, A. That B, we have to let them know that the person who's responsible for this is no longer a threat to anyone. You have to let them know that they're safe, and then you have to get back to your regular routine in life. Especially during these times, we all crave structure. We all crave the safety. In a world that seems completely and unbelievably unsafe, we will find comfort and safety in those routines that remind us that, you know, life is normal. We have to find a new normal, and we have to find a way to get through it every day. And getting through it with each other and supporting and loving one another is really what it's about.
That's LeVar Burton. He's the executive producer and host of Reading Rainbow, which ran on PBS stations from 1983 to 2009. And over the past 24 hours, we've struggled on this program to figure out whether today we should leave music out. This is the place in the program we normally have an interview with an artist or a band. But we decided that our guest is worth hearing, if only because even for just these next few minutes, he will bring some joy into your day. And joy is what André Rieu does best. Over the past decade, André Rieu has become the king of the waltz. And he's not some fancy or stuffy classical composer and conductor. He's a person who's worked to demystify classical music. He encourages people to stand up and dance during his performances. He moves as well. And as you can imagine, he's left the classical establishment somewhat annoyed. André Rieu is the Dutch violinist and conductor of the Johann Strauss Orchestra. And over the course of the last 25 years, he's built an empire out of the waltz, and today he's quite possibly the most commercially successful classical artist in history. André Rieu's latest release is an album and a DVD of Christmas music. It's called Home for the Holidays. When I spoke with André Rieu, he was at home in Maastricht, Holland, in his castle. Yes, the man lives in a castle. And I asked him why the simple waltz has earned him such great success.
I think it has to do with, of course, the rhythm, the 1-2-3 rhythm. And it has to do with the fact that you have to recompose the waltz every night. When you don't do that, it's terrible to play a waltz because then it's da-dee-da-dum, jump, 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 and that's dead. No, you should play dee-da-dee-dum, jump, 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 and then you see the whole audience starting to move and to smile and to dance and to laugh, and that's what I want to achieve.
You can't imagine that happening in, like, I don't know, the Met or something. People dancing in the aisles. Well, yeah, but it just doesn't, right?
No, because they don't play the waltzes like I do.
You, of course, are so tied to Johann Strauss. You play so much of his music. How did he become the person? I mean, of course, he's not alive, but he's one of the most important people in your life.
Yeah, a lot of people believe in reincarnation. I don't believe that, but when you look at my life, you almost would believe that there are things true in that story. But I think it's part of my character. It's in my genes from the beginning. And perhaps my father has to do also with it. My father was a conductor, all sort of classical music. And then during the encores, he loved to play Strauss waltz. And I was in the audience, like when I was a little boy. And what I saw, the audience was very concentrated and stiff, you know. Nobody dared to move when he played his classical music. But then during this encores, the whole audience around me started to move and to smile. And it was a completely different audience. And that struck me. And I thought, my God, this is what I want to do.
The classical music had been something for the elite, for people who were educated or people who were somehow smarter, and you felt that that was the way it was, and you had to end that.
Exactly, yeah. I think classical music is so beautiful. It's a way to become a better human being. At the same time, there's a huge fear with a lot of people. No, I'm not educated in classical music, and I want to take them this fear away. I take away all the stiffness and the elitaire thing, and I tell the people, be yourself when you come to my concert and do whatever you want.
Andre, explain how you playing Strauss and you playing waltzes would be different for somebody going to a major metropolitan symphony somewhere around the world and hearing it.
So when I play with my orchestra, it's a very carefully built orchestra. I choose musicians who want to make music, not for money. I was so angry when I was in a symphony orchestra myself 100 years ago.
You were a violinist in a symphony in Holland, just one of the nameless or faceless folks in that crowd,
exactly. And I was sitting there, and all my colleagues were speaking only about the union, and we want more money, and it's too cold here, and when is the holiday, and nobody spoke about, oh my God, the concert yesterday was so beautiful. No, never. And then when there was a program with waltzes, or there was a waltz to play, the conductor who said, oh my God, we have 4 minutes left of the rehearsal, take the waltz quickly and then we play it, or even without rehearsal. And that made me very angry, because that's not the way waltzes should be played.
It's interesting to hear you talk about anger, because everything I've read about you says, and this is a person who is unflappable, who is totally and completely positive to the point where you're not really sure if it's possible. Let me ask you something about criticism of Andre Rieu. Critics who follow classical music have said, this is a man who has sort of makes Disney music for grown-ups, who has debased this incredible art form. You've read that, you've seen it. What do you make of it?
A lot of people who say that were never in a concert of me, so I don't know.
Does it hurt your feelings?
It depends who says it, of course. But mostly it doesn't hurt my feelings, because I do it now for 35 years, and a lot of critics, I even spoke to them and I said, did you ever come to a concert? No, I don't. And then some of them came to concerts and they said after the concert, I changed my mind.
I'm looking at a list of the highest grossing artists around the world. U2 is number one, Bon Jovi number two. You are number nine. You are ahead of Katy Perry and Justin Bieber, just behind Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga should be a little nervous, though. You are right on her tail there. You are almost the number eight biggest grossing artist in the world. Did it surprise you?
No, it never surprised me because it took me a very long time to have a record label who wanted to sign me. They said, what do you play? Waltzes? Oh, my God. Where do you live? In Maastricht in the South? Please go back to the South and play there for your grandmother. And I said, please come to a concert and you will see the people are mad. The people are crazy. 7 years long, nobody from the record company came to my concert. And then one day, one guy came and he said, I understand what you mean.
I want to end our conversation, Andre, with one last piece. It's called December Lights on your new record, and this is actually a composition of yours, a new composition of yours. Tell me about it.
I knew that I wanted to make a Christmas special, and it's a whole story about how I celebrate Christmas. And I reminded myself of the day that I met Marjorie, and I was a poor student.
You were 11 years old, and she was 13, is that right?
Yes, that was the first time, but then I met her. And that was the moment that we fell in love, and that was at Christmas time in Brussels. And I was a poor student studying at the conservatory there, and really the only thing I had was my violin and my clothes. And there she came, and it was very cold, and we warmed each other, and that was it.
And you've been married now how long?
37 years.
Congratulations, that's incredible.
Thank you very much.
Andre Rieu is one of the best-selling performers in the world. His new Christmas release is called Home for the Holidays. He, of course, is also known as the King of the Waltz. Maestro Rieu, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas. Happy Holidays to you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And you can see an excerpt from his new DVD at our website, nprmusic.org. We leave you tonight with a poem by Yusuf Komunyakaa. He wrote it last night after hearing about the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary, and we asked him to read it for us tonight. It's called Rock Me Mercy.
The river stones are listening because we have something to say. The trees lean closer today. The singing in the electrical woods has gone dumb. It looks like rain because it is too warm to snow. Guardian angels, wherever you're hiding, we know you can't be everywhere at once. Have you corralled all the pretty wild horses. The memory of ants asleep and daylilies, roses, holly, and larkspur. The magpies gaze at us, still waiting. River stones are listening, but all we can say now is, mercy, please rock me.
The poet Yusuf Kamanyaka reading his poem, Rock Me Mercy. For the week ending December 16, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening, and please keep the people of Newtown in your thoughts.